Hey, it's me, Lars Larson. Thanks for checking out my podcast, and be sure to tell a friend about the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and emails on this Tuesday. Boy, we have so much to talk about. We'll get to our Twitter poll. Should a school be able to suspend a student from school over a pro-Donald Trump T-shirt? I'll tell you the story, but some of it is going to sound awfully familiar if you listen to this program on a regular basis because... well, because we've introduced you to Addison Barnes before, a young man who approached me more than a month ago and said, I got kicked out of school for wearing this shirt. The shirt refers to the Border Wall Construction Company, and we'll give you all the details on that. He has now brought a lawsuit, and I think he's exactly right to do that. A lawsuit against the badly named Washington County School, Liberty High School, which decided to suspend him from class merely for wearing a T-shirt that contain no profanity, no references to alcohol, no references to drugs, legal or otherwise, no references to any of that, no references to guns. And yet they kicked him out of school because he had a pro-Donald Trump T-shirt. Today's Twitter poll can be found at Lars Larson Show, also at LarsLarson.com, and always brought to you by Ultimate Truck Service. If you rely on trucks for your business, keep your biggest assets on the road and running right online at UltimateTruckService.com. Now, where I wanted to start today is, I think, a very big travesty of justice. And here's what's going on. There is a convicted killer. Convicted triple murderer Brent Leister. Brent Leister was sentenced Monday. Brent Leister is still pending sentencing. His girlfriend was sentenced on Monday in federal court. And I'm going to tell you what she got her sentence for. And then you tell me whether or not you think that justice was done in a case like this. This young lady, Andrea Sibley, she has done so many things wrong, and I say that knowing that she's already been found guilty of these things, but she is getting such light punishment that it makes me want to ask, if we're really serious about stopping violent crime, why in the world are we giving such light sentences to people who've committed such heinous crimes? So let me tell you what happened in this case. What happened was this young lady, Andrea Sibley, convicted, was sentenced for buying 9 different firearms for Brent Leister, the convicted triple murderer who is still waiting for his sentencing. The 9 firearms were listed in the July and used in the July 2016 slayings of Leister's best friend, Zachary David Thompson, 36, his friend Joseph Mark Lamar, 38, and Lamar's partner, Janelle Renee Knight, 43. So Leister shot all 3 of these people, and he used a gun to kill them. And the gun came from his girlfriend, who went out and did what is called a straw purchase. Now, here's what a straw purchase is. You walk into a gun store to buy a firearm anywhere in America, because this is federal law, not state law. I've answered these questions 100 times. Well, maybe not 100, maybe 50 times in my lifetime. It's called the Form 4473. On it, it asks you a whole bunch of different questions about your citizenship, about whether or not you're a legal or illegal alien. It asks you about drug use, and it asks you, are you buying this gun for yourself or are you buying it for someone else? You are not allowed in the United States of America to purchase a firearm for someone else. If somebody wants to buy a gun, that person has to buy the gun for himself or herself. So they ask you straight out, are you buying the gun for yourself? This young lady, Andrea Sibley, purchased the guns for her boyfriend because her boyfriend was a convicted criminal. He would not have been able to buy the guns himself. He was legally prohibited from it. Now, do you know when things, terrible, terrible things, like the shooting at Parkland, Florida at the high school, terrible things like the shootings last Friday at Santa Fe High in Texas, when those things happen and you hear people like me say, why don't you enforce the laws you already have? This is a great example of that kind of law, because most of the people who are criminals either steal the guns that they're going to use in a crime, or they go out and get somebody with a clean criminal record like Andrea Sibley to go out and buy it for them. And usually, for the person who's doing the straw purchase, that is buying a gun not for themselves, but to supply to somebody else, it can be tremendously lucrative. Because what they do typically, I've talked about a few cases like this on this program, The person with a clean criminal record goes out and buys a pistol for $500, then sells it for $1,000 to a criminal who can't buy a pistol because of his or her criminal record. You make $500 on the deal, and it is thoroughly illegal. Every part of it is illegal. It's considered such a serious federal crime, it's illegal to even attempt to do it. If you attempt to buy a pistol, even if you never get your hands on the pistol or rifle, that is a crime in and of itself. This young lady did it 9 different times. What is she going to get for her conviction for committing such a serious crime 9 different times, including putting guns in the hands of a man who is now convicted of a triple homicide using the very guns that she supplied? She is getting 1 year in prison. 1 year. Now, I know, because I've looked this up before, that merely the act of signing the application, the Form 4473, if you put untrue information on that form, it is called false swearing. It's perjury on paper is what it amounts to. The crime is punishable by 5 years in federal prison. This woman did it 9 different times, putting guns in the hands of a dangerous felon, and she's getting 1 year in prison. Not 5 years, not 10 years, not 45 years for doing a 5-year crime 9 different times. She's getting 1 year in prison. Now listen to this. U.S. District Judge Benjamin Settle said guns are being used to take lives of innocent people at an alarming rate. So it is a serious crime when a person is helping someone who shouldn't have guns to get guns. You had to know that somebody was going to get hurt by these firearms, but that did not deter you. Now, the federal prosecutor said this woman should get at least 18 months in prison. I think that would have been a Christmas gift. 18 months for 9 different times. In other words, you make money, you supply guns to a dangerous person who uses them to kill people, and you get 2 months in prison for every gun that you've transferred into the hands of this person. The firearms were discovered after Leister and Sibley invited Leister's former girlfriend over to their Longview home. That was in May 2 years ago. He allegedly punched and pistol whipped his former girlfriend, fired shots at her as she ran from the home. Sibley witnessed the alleged assault, but did not help. After the woman escaped, Sibley left the home with her son and the other woman's child. She was stopped by responding sheriff's deputies as she was driving away, but she denied knowing anything about the gunshots in the area. Deputies arrived. They found Leister. They convinced him to surrender. They found 3 of the firearms near where Leister was located, 6 others inside the house. He was arrested. And on June the 6th, 2 years ago, his bail was cut in part because Andrea Sibley wrote a letter on his behalf, said, please let him out. A little more than a month later, Leister committed the Woodland shooting. So in other words, she helped get him the guns. She wrote the letter to get him out of jail on bail. And then he takes one of the firearms and he murders 3 people. And her role in it was a very, very involved role. And she gets 1 year in jail. What lesson do you think that sends? Why don't we throw the book at people like this? It is certainly available. The punishments are right there in the laws, and we're not using them. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Welcome to Honestly Provocative Talk Radio on the Radio Northwest Network. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com.
That makes a lot of sense, a lot of nonsense.
Right, you're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say.
This is the Northwest Nonsense, presented by the Ryan Group, where they guarantee to sell your house in 29 days or less, or they'll buy it. 29andgone.com.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
No left-leaning, dead fish rapper bias. No mega TV network liberal agenda. Just the cold hard facts from Lars.
Addison Barnes sought me out a month ago when I was giving a speech to the Columbia County GOP dinner, the Lincoln Day dinner. This well-spoken high school student made it a point to bring a T-shirt with him that night, and he told me the story of the day that his rather ironically named Liberty High School kicked him out for wearing a political message. The shirt doesn't have any messages about alcohol, illegal drugs, or violence, not even guns. It merely echoes the political theme that put Donald J. Trump in the White House a year and a half ago. Border Wall Construction Company. Addison points out that his school tolerates messages on clothing about sexual preference, about abortion, and other political causes. Yet it rejects a conservative message of support for a real barrier on our southern border. Now he's brought a lawsuit against the school district. School administrators and the local school board might do well to read a bit of history about the First Amendment free speech before they waste the taxpayers' money fighting a losing cause. The Supreme Court decided 50 years ago in Cohen versus California, the case often referred to as the F the draft case for radio purposes, and free speech won in that case. If the school's trying to defend this unconstitutional rule, then it tells us they have money to burn, and we are free to vote accordingly at the next election.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe they're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now. Brought to you by Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks. Rock, granite, topsoil, or sand. Let Dan Jones Conveyor Trucks put it where you want it.
Well, I always tell you if I have a dog in a fight in a particular case, and in this case, I have to admit a couple of dogs in the fight. At one point, the radio station that I work for was owned by Paul Allen. It hasn't been owned by Paul Allen for almost a decade, so that's a partial possible bias I might have. I also tend to like the Flying Heritage Museum. That's in Everett, just north of Seattle. It's a great collection of airplanes, but there's more than airplanes there as well. There are some tanks there, and they're all the personal property of billionaire Paul Allen. I got nothing against Mr. Allen. He's a perfectly nice guy, although his politics are a little bit on the liberal side. But I wanted to give him the grill today, and I'll tell you why. One of the things Paul Allen likes to collect is tanks. He has a Sherman tank. He has a Panzer tank. They work. And they actually fire. Now, they don't fire live rounds very often, but they have fired the blank rounds out the barrel, so the tanks still work. And yet, despite all that and his collection of his own personal tank collection, he may be the only guy in the Pacific Northwest who's a private individual who has a private collection of real working military tanks, who also just gave $1 million to a gun control effort. Mr. Allen. We don't know each other well. We've met each other on a couple of occasions, and they were completely forgettable, so I'm sure you don't remember me. But why in the world would you spend $1 million to try to help out a group trying to take away my right to keep and bear arms when you get to keep and bear some of the biggest arms anywhere in the state of Washington? Anyway, you get the grill today for that. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk at LarsLarson.com, comes in from Janet. Lars, after 15 years of being a loyal Netflix consumer, I have canceled my subscription. I feel this was the last straw. Netflix has chosen to snub its loyal customers, working-class American, and hire the Obamas. I was disappointed with them bringing on Susan Rice, but this is the last straw. On a side note, I don't know Obama had any experience in documentaries or directorial projects. It's just another political move by Netflix, and I hear their message loud and clear. Now all they need is Hillary to complete their felonious team. The Netflix CEO is a huge supporter of Hillary Clinton and her leftist agenda. Netflix is canceled in my home. Please encourage your listeners to do the same. Thanks, Lars. Signed, Janet. Janet, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk at LarsLarson.com.
Do the right thing.
It's the right thing to do.
If you do, you could get Lars's props and kudos.
Congratulations.
Congratulations.
If you ask almost anyone what is the singular emblem of the city of Seattle, it is the Space Needle, and most people know that. And then you say, do you know who owns the Space Needle? And usually, if you're talking to people who don't know the history of the Space Needle, they'll say, well, I suppose the city of Seattle owns it. Oh, perish the thought. Some of the best monuments anywhere in America are not owned by the government. And usually the ones that are well-run are not owned by the government. For example, Mount Vernon, George Washington's home, is not owned by the government. It's owned by a private charity. The Alamo, not owned by the government, it is owned by a private charity. And the Space Needle, that singular, symbol of the entire city of Seattle, is not owned by the government, thank God. It is 56 years old. I remember going to it as a little kid when my parents took me to the World's Fair. They are now going to remodel it. It is owned by a private family that has run it very, very nicely. In fact, I've suggested an awful lot of America's monuments would be a whole lot better managed if they were managed by private entrepreneurs or private families or private corporations, because private corporations know the value of a dollar. And all the government knows is that it's other people's money, OPM, and it spends like water. Well, they're about to do a $100 million renovation of the Space Needle. And this is something that the economists, and I don't know how correct they are with this, but Seattle City and King County benefit from an estimated $7.4 billion in spending by about 40 million visitors last year. Not every single one of them came to Seattle just to see the Space Needle, but it is part of the landscape. And Seattle Visit Seattle is a nonprofit advocacy group. The Seattle Wright family, which built and owns the Space Needle, is installing floor-to-ceiling glass in the observation deck. They're remodeling the restaurant in the first phase of the renovation. They're repainting the entire exterior of the 600-foot structure and replacing its three elevators. All of that to make the place a better place, and all done by a private family that is doing it because of their love for the city and because it's run as a private enterprise operation. Heck, even that tram outside of Palm Springs that goes up in the mountains is run as a private operation. Just a thought. The next time somebody says to you, well, we ought to have the government do that. And then just ask yourself, which one do you think is better operated? Mount Vernon, the Alamo, the Space Needle, or the post office and Amtrak and your local DMV? And I think you'll know why I usually auger in the direction of allowing private sector individuals and private sector groups to do this kind of thing. The government does not know how to do it right. They could screw up an ice cream sundae most days of the week. But in this case, a private family is getting it done, and the symbol of Seattle will stay in great shape, not because of the government. If the government was doing it, it probably cost $1 billion instead of $100 million. Your phone calls at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network and the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'll be glad to get to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com, and you hear me talk about the President of the United States and about the tax reform that Donald Trump managed to bring about at the federal level, which I thought was tremendous news, and it was so unexpected. And it was so improbable that a brand new president, much maligned by the media, would walk into office and within a year, less than a year of taking office, would manage to convince a Congress that doesn't seem capable of getting its shoes tied to be able to bring about the first major tax reform in almost a third of a century. But you can hear me talk about it all day long. What we want to talk about is the fact that it's actually doing some great things at the state level as well. And joining me in studio, and he doesn't often get a chance to be on this program in studio, and I don't often get a chance to see you face-to-face, is Jonathan Williams, the chief economist and vice president for ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, right?
Absolutely. Thanks for having me, and it's good to see you in person. I bring you greetings from the land of make-believe, Washington, D.C., where we're based.
Well, and tell me about this. You put out this report called Rich States, Poor States, and it describes how all of this is actually working out where the rubber meets the road out there in the states as these tax reforms have gone through.
So we at ALEC, I mean, we believe strongly in the idea of the 50 laboratories of democracy, and that our lawmakers and state capitals across the country are putting now the second wave of tax reform to good work. You know, as you mentioned, we saw the first success in 31 long years since President Reagan at the federal level because of Donald Trump and Congress. Now the states have their turn because the state tax codes link back to the federal tax code. And now we're seeing the second windfall of tax reform, and that is happening for the hardworking men and women across the states, which is something that the mainstream media in Washington hasn't been spending a lot of time talking about.
No, because you can see the benefits at the national level when you saw big corporations get tax cuts. And of course, the skepticism from the left who said, well, they'll just send it back to their owners or their dividend holders or their stockholders. But in fact, an awful lot of that money flowed right back out to the people who are making just above minimum wage, people who are employees of those companies.
Yeah, over 500 businesses now we have seen at the federal level give wage increases, bonuses. They're making more investments. They're giving more charitable contributions. And by the way, when they do well with their stocks, all these pension funds that are hurting across the country that we continue to see in the news facing bankruptcy, guess what? Those teacher pension funds do a lot better too. So the benefits are being spread out. Where the naysayers were absolutely wrong in talking about how this would first be Armageddon, secondly be crumbs. We're seeing real results. And now the states have the next chance to take this just after, like we saw after Ronald Reagan's tax reform in 86, we saw a record number of states cut taxes. I think we're going to see that in 2018 and 2019 in the state capitals.
Well, Jonathan, I'm almost afraid that when you say over 500 businesses, people might not be aware that some of those businesses are, say, Walmart with 1 million employees, other companies. So among those 500, many of them were huge employers that employ hundreds of thousands, if not more than 1 million people, aren't they?
Yep. Kudos to AT&T for being the first to go out there and talk about this. And then your point on Walmart is exactly right in that they raised their base wage at Walmart now for the average line worker or the greeter now making much more directly because of federal tax reform. And Lars, you know this. I mean, businesses are pretty hesitant to go out there publicly and talk about the benefits of conservative policies and free market policies. So to see some of America's largest public-facing corporations making these announcements of Christmas bonuses and long-term wage increases, that was a huge deal, I think.
Jonathan, I know that you're going to spend some time down in Salem, the state capital of the state we're in today, because my broadcast studios are in Portland, Oregon. But how many states are going the direction Oregon is going, which is to say decoupling from the federal tax cuts, and how many of them are going the opposite direction?
So I have to say it's very rare to see what Oregon has done. I mean, we're talking about how much states are cutting taxes and using the opportunity of federal tax reform to bring relief to their men and women back home. So, I mean, Oregon stands on an island. We talk about Washington being an island surrounded by reality. In fact, I think Oregon might fit that definition because of how it's handled the federal tax reform. We are not seeing states try to avoid bringing the benefits of this tax reform to its small businesses like we saw in Oregon.
Well, and in fact, we might see more of it because one of the things I talked to another economist about the other night is the way other countries are reacting to this. Because some other countries which have had either higher rates or they were competitive rates to America's old federal tax rate, but they're not competitive now that we've dropped down, some of those countries are starting to say, well, maybe we have to cut our rates as well. Or the companies within their borders will say, hey, America's looking better all the time.
You remember the inversion craze where we were losing companies to become Irish companies or Canadian companies. I mean, Burger King right now is a Canadian company because of tax reasons. It's not that Canadians love Whoppers any more than Americans love Whoppers. Well, we could see that absolutely reverse. And so the Canadians and other countries in Europe are now saying, hey, wait a minute. We took advantage of the United States for 30 years because of our basically economic malpractice on the corporate tax rate. That is reversing. Now we're, United States is back to average now. But when you add the 21% to the average state and local rate, we're at the OECD average. So that's very good for America to compete on an equal playing field. But for the countries that took advantage of us and attracted our companies and our businesses to go overseas for tax reasons, that game's over. And guess what? They've got to keep up with the Joneses in this case.
Well, it's funny that you mentioned Oregon as being an island because almost every state has either a state bureaucracy whose only goal is to bring new business into the state. They go by various names. They often, you know, sponsor junkets where politicians get to go to China and they get to go to Germany and they do all this and they say, we're going to bring business back. How's that going to work out for states that raise taxes, as Oregon is doing, versus states that have said, hey, the feds are cutting rates. If we cut rates, we're going to make ourselves look even better to potential foreign investors to come in and establish plant and facilities here.
No, I mean, it's really economic malpractice at the state level because in rich states, poor states, our book every year, we rank the states on economic competitiveness with Art Laffer. Oregon comes in, for instance, at 41 this year. So when you go around with
41.
That on your resume, I mean, that's a killer in terms of trying to bring in, even with the U.S. now doing better on the corporate rate nationally, when you have the barriers to entry at the state level and you're number 41 going around talking about come into our state, people don't take you seriously, right?
So in those states where they're actually following what Congress did, what are they doing? And give us a couple of examples of that one.
Well, two of the biggest examples that we saw move the most in the new rich states, poor states rankings were Idaho It moved all the way from number 10 to number 2, and the biggest tax reform in about 25 years in that state, reducing both the personal and the corporate tax rates directly because of federal tax reform and the huge windfall that it provided to its state's budget. Georgia moved up from number 17 to number 11. So we've seen some big movement, and just in the last week, we saw Iowa and Missouri. Friday, Missouri cut taxes for the first time in a couple of decades, moving their tax rates down significantly. So we've seen four big reforms on the board already because of rate reduction. So instead of states going around picking winners and losers and giving special handouts for companies coming in, these states are taking the advantage that federal reform has provided them and permanently reducing rates. So talk about a resume when you're looking at bringing in companies either overseas or from other states. Instead of going around saying we're number 41, we'll give you all these goodies, these states are permanently reducing rates to make themselves more competitive.
I'm talking to Jonathan Williams, who is the chief economist and vice president for ALEC, the American Legislative Exchange Council, and the author of Rich States, Poor States. Is there any particular way that they are cutting or kinds of taxes that are cutting that are aimed more at bringing more job producers in?
Well, and these states are doing exactly the right thing. So they're cutting income taxes, both business income taxes and individual income taxes, because as you know, Lars, individual income taxes affect small business income. With anybody on the pass-through side, small businesses on subchapter sole proprietorships across the board. So instead of some states like Oregon disallowing those businesses from taking the benefits of federal reform, these states are putting the accelerator on reducing rates for the job creators out there.
So those are the kinds of things that they're going after. Capital gains, any of those that they're making changes to in some of the states, do you know?
Capital gains, dividend, ordinary income, business investment income. We're not seeing them go after, you know, other forms of taxes. We're seeing them focus on the exact form of taxes that they should be focusing on, the ones that will bring the greatest economic growth and most job creation. So that's the exciting news from the states.
Now, Jonathan, I want to ask you about one other thing. This may be a level you don't normally look at, but cities. Because the city of Seattle just finished whacking Amazon in particular and about 500 or 600 other businesses. And these are not small businesses. These are the golden geese. These are the businesses above 20 million gross. Although 20 million gross doesn't mean 20 million profit. It just means you gross 20 million. They hit them with this huge head tax, 275. I think it may well get thrown to the ballot and it may well get repealed. But now Cupertino, California, that's Apple, isn't it? They're looking at doing the same thing Seattle did. What about those moves?
Pure economic suicide, Lars, is these Seattle head tax moves. We're already seeing the counties like Pierce County and suburban Seattle saying, come on in, no head tax here. Businesses come across, go 2 miles across the county line into the surrounding counties and avoid this head tax. So as we're following HQ2 for Amazon, looking to move, and they're down to 20 locations, and I think they're going to end up in a free market spot, probably on the East Coast. It kind of begs the question, though, what about HQ1? What's it going to take? What's going to be the breaking point for Seattle to actually lose the golden geese? As you mentioned, big companies like Amazon, like Microsoft, that have been funding that city for many, many years. What's it going to take? I wouldn't want to play that roulette game if I were them, that's for sure.
And Cupertino's doing this at a time when I've read, isn't Apple, now that they finished the first flying saucer, talking about building another one somewhere else?
Yeah, and that's a company that is getting huge dividends because of federal tax reform. So that's a company that should be doing very well right now. But, of course, a brand new hurdle put up by evidently a city that doesn't want them located there.
I guess not. And they should all be voting Republican as well. It is such a pleasure, Jonathan. Thanks so much. And congratulations on Rich States, Poor States.
Thanks so much. Take care.
Glad to see you in person. We'll be back in just a moment. We'll get your calls, too, at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Now, I've got a theory on why this is happening, but let me tell you the facts first and then the theory about why it's happening. There's a brand new report out. This has to do, and I have a feeling Seattle won't be far behind. On a yearly basis, the city of Portland now sees as many property crimes as the city of Atlanta. Not as many per 100,000, as many crimes as the much bigger city of Atlanta. And it's growing. Last year, the number of property crimes grew from 33,000 to 38,000. Now, that's about a 20% jump in a single year. And here's what's going on.
They're saying, and property crimes, by the way, thefts of bicycles, thefts of automobiles, thefts of personal property, all of those things are happening. Apparently, we had about 51 property crimes per 1,000 people, about the same rate as Atlanta, Georgia. Also significantly higher property crime rates compared to cities like Salem, Eugene, and Hillsborough. Salem, for example, saw 40 property crimes per 1,000. I'm looking up the numbers for Seattle, but here's my theory. When you invite a whole bunch of homeless people and bums, many of whom are drug addicts, into an area, I think that you're going to get a critical mass of thieves, since I would imagine that most of the people who are shooting heroin, the ones that are smoking methamphetamine, taking cocaine, and all those other crimes are not able to finance that on their minimum wage job. And I'm guessing that if you're a regular user of heroin on a day-to-day basis, the best you've got is a minimum wage job. If not, you have probably no job at all, which means you have to get the money to supply that addiction by stealing things. So now you have a huge property crime problem. We talked the other day about the fact that Portland is now number two to Baltimore, Maryland, in the number of car thefts that are happening per capita. So you have a huge crime problem that apparently is not being addressed because you're inviting the thieves in. That's my theory anyway. I'll be glad to hear your theories too. At 866-439-5277, let's go to John. John, you heard me talking about Paul Allen, who I have no personal gripe with, but he has a huge collection of working military tanks, a collection I'm actually envious of. I'd love to have a collection like that, but it seems odd that a guy who owns his own working tanks would give $1 million to try to groups to try to take away the Second Amendment rights of American citizens who simply want to own an ordinary pistol or rifle.
I know it is a little bit ironic considering the amount of, I guess, the history behind what he owns and what he can actually do. So I went to a machine gun shoot in 2010, I think it was.
Yeah.
And I wound up talking to the owner of, it was an M18 Hellcat tank destroyer. And I think this guy actually died a few years ago in an explosion in that tank he was filming for, I think it was a History Channel show.
Yeah.
Anyway, I wound up talking to him, just kind of more or less being a, smart aleck about the cost of shooting the cannon that he had. And he was telling me that the M18 tank destroyer has the same cannon that's on an M4A3 Sherman tank, basically like the one you saw in Fury.
Yep.
So, picture a 30-06 round that's about 2.5 to 3 feet tall. And if he actually wants to shoot this thing, like make it a live gun, he has to go through the ATF.
Yeah.
They have to approve the breech lock, I believe is what it is, which is X amount of dollars, which is actually not that much. But to actually shoot it, because any round considered by the ATF over 50 caliber that's an actual shell casing round, like not a cannon or an old musket, each round has a $200...
Oh, the fee, like you'd have to pay a $200 fee on a suppressor or on a gun that's
right.
That's covered outside of
but
the normal pistols and rifles.
Yeah, but anything over 50 caliber, like a 50 BMG, whatever you want to call it, is considered a destructive device. So each bullet in and of itself has a $200 tax fee, tax stamp, et cetera, et cetera.
I would imagine that Paul Allen can probably pay the freight in a case like that. Back in just a moment, you're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm glad to get your phone calls and your emails at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. One of the best parts about my job is we usually find out about Supreme Court decisions fairly quickly, and some of them are really big. They are decisions that change the way people work, the way they get paid, the way they get treated in their work. And there was just one of those decisions this week. In a 5-4 ruling, the justices said that arbitration agreements that bar employees from joining together in arbitration to settle labor disputes are enforceable under the Federal Arbitration Act. I know that's enough legal gobbledygook to make almost anybody's eyes glaze over. Well, except for the guy that we always call on to try to explain how this actually applies to real life, and that is Professor Tung Yin, who is Lewis and Clark Law Professor, all-around good guy and our go-to guy when it comes to explaining these things. Professor Tung, it's good to have you on the program again.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
So tell me this. I read through this thing a couple of times. Essentially, it sounds like the employees who are not unionized decided we want to go in and file a class action lawsuit against our boss, against our employer, because we think, that we were owed something that we didn't get paid. Is that the gist of it?
I think one thing to add, in the majority's view, it doesn't affect the legal analysis, but it's obviously quite important to the dissent's policy argument, is that their individual claims were probably so small that it wouldn't have been worth it for them to have arbitrated individually. And so what they needed to do was to have the class action to aggregate their claims so that it would be worthwhile for a lawyer to take on the case.
Is there a way to give an example of, because we're talking about things that were such a small deal. This isn't somebody who got cheated out of, $10,000 in wages. This is smaller than that, or am I misunderstanding that?
I think that these are the claims involved the Fair Labor Standards Act. So, certain amounts of overtime and or minimum wage payments and so on. But the question is that if you were if the employer violated your rights, but either not very often or at a very low level, then the amount that you can claim would be for however, all of the different violations added up. But if that ends up being a fairly small amount, the problem is going to get a lawyer to represent you in arbitration, where the lawyer might look at it and say, I'm sorry, this is not worth my time, because the lawyer typically on a contingency basis might take one third of the recovery. Well, one third of a small amount is
a smaller amount. Yeah. So in that case, doesn't that suggest that these are employees who are either, if you can't work it out with your boss and you go to your boss, say, hey, boss, I think I was owed overtime for the last 10 Friday nights that you had me stay late. And the boss says, well, I don't think so. Usually there's some pretty good resources at the state level where you go to the state's either Bureau of Labor and Industries or Labor and Industries. They're all called slightly different names. And if they won't go to bat for you, and if the claim is so small, it doesn't even make sense for a lawyer to take it up. Why are we seeing these things aggregated together into a giant class action lawsuit in which the lawyers are still going to take most of the money and leave almost nothing left over for the employees who actually brought the action? This sounds like something that's just designed to damage the employer without really doing much benefit to the employees, or am I reading that wrong?
Well, that is, of course, the analogy to just the regular class actions, not about labor or wage payments, but just simply you periodically get these little mailings from some law firm that says you are a member of the class.
And you're owed $5.25 from whatever company. And you think, or less.
Worse yet, usually you just get a coupon for further purchases. But in any event, I think that there is a very interesting philosophical and policy question of whether class actions per se are a good thing or a bad thing. And of course, on the generally on the corporation side, the argument is they're bad because it's the lawyers, the class action lawyers, who walk away with the money, and the class members get these useless coupons or some pittance payments. But the proponents of the class action will say that it provides some deterrence on behalf of bad acting corporations. So, that's the analogy. I guess what you could say on the side of the plaintiffs in this case is, even if the amount of money is relatively small, there has to be some mechanism to deter employers from cheating them, even if it's small cheating rather than a big amount. But I think what this case comes down to is the majority's argument is simply, or analysis is simply, let's look at the language of the statute. The Arbitration Act says that these are the things that can be entered into an agreement to arbitrate claims in advance of the dispute. That is to say, we're doing this up front. If we get into a dispute, we agree we're going to arbitrate it.
Right.
Do we agree? Are you signing? And so on. And as long as there hasn't been fraud, coercion, duress, anything like that, that it's generally going to be enforceable. And the dissent's argument is essentially, well, but this is really bad policy because it's not worth it to the individual employees. And that might be an appealing argument. I mean, it may or may not be. But I think that that argument makes more sense at the legislative level, which is to say, if you were a member of Congress and another congressperson said, hey, we should amend the Federal Arbitration Act because there are going to be these situations where these employees individually, it's not going to be worth it to them to sue. Maybe they should be able to aggregate their claims. That might be a persuasive argument for changing statutes. But I think that the majority has the better argument in terms of we're looking at the language as it's written now, not as you think it should be written.
Now, Professor, I know you're in the business of churning out new lawyers at Lewis and Clark Law School, but tell me if I'm wrong about this. I hear people complain about arbitration all the time. They say, I'm being forced into arbitration. I said, no, you ought to be glad you're in arbitration, because if you bring a lawsuit, the result of the lawsuit, even if it's a win for you, can be appealed. And then it can be appealed again and appealed again, and it can go on forever, and it can burn up tremendous amounts of lawyer time without producing a result, a final result for anyone. Arbitration tends to be you get a result, and whether you're happy with it or not, the thing is over, and both sides have finality. They have a final resolution of the matter one way or the other. And so I've always thought that arbitration was a better way to go. I've been through an arbitration myself, and the lawyer said, boy, if you were in a court case, first of all, it cost you twice as much at the front end, and secondly, they could appeal and appeal and appeal, and it'll go on forever. If you're in an arbitration, whatever the result is, it's a final result. Was that the correct way to look at it?
Well, there's that. I should have disclosed this up front, that back when I was practicing, half my practice was employment law. And part of what I did was compel people who sued our clients into arbitration when we were able to do so.
Good.
But I think that one thing to keep in mind is that most lawsuits actually settle. It's all, even fewer of them go to trial than on the criminal side.
Yeah.
And so The question is, what sort of procedural advantages do you get in arbitration versus court? And in court, there's usually more discovery, and the threat of the jury possibly just going crazy and awarding some large amount of money may induce corporations to settle at a higher amount than they might in arbitration. I think that would be one thing that plaintiffs might point to. But otherwise, if you are actually going to go to battle and not settle, then arbitration does provide a more streamlined process. And you're right that generally you can't appeal the arbitrator's award. That's one of the things that the Federal Arbitration Act holds.
Yeah, because it means if you, the employee, win in a lawsuit, it can be appealed and appealed, and it can stretch the timeline out a long, long ways. And if you're the employee and you just want a result one way or the other, you want to win. But if you win and then it's going to be appealed, and that's going to take another couple of years and more lawyer money, and then that result can be appealed, that doesn't sound very appealing.
Right. But remember, the ones who are motivated to get a resolution are probably more likely to settle. To reach some settlement where they figure, well, it's not perfect, but at least I can just be over with it. Because settlement, of course, is going to be quite final,
right,
as well. It's the ones who really want their day in court that maybe the prospect of facing endless appeals doesn't bother them as much, because they may be the ones doing the appealing. If they lose at the court, then they, of course, they can appeal it. And, I'll take it all the way to the Supreme Court.
Professor, it's a pleasure as well, as always. Professor Tung Yin, who is a Lewis and Clark Law School professor, we appreciate your insights.
Yeah, thanks for having me on.
You bet. That's about the Supreme Court decision this week that said, nope, if you've got an arbitration agreement, that's the thing you're going to have to stick with. That's the way the federal rules were written, and it's the way the employment agreement that you signed was written. Seems right to stick with that then. Back in just a moment. Glad to get your calls at 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@LarsLarson.com. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. I get little updates throughout the day, on top of the 6 hours of prep we do every morning for this program. But the Washington Times, after the big controversy over President Donald Trump calling certain members of certain foreign national gangs in America, describing them as animals, Well, an MS-13 member, that's a Hispanic street gang, who goes by the gang nickname Animal, has received a 40-year prison sentence for a conspiracy that included the murder of a 15-year-old boy. That's from the U.S. Attorney's Office in Massachusetts. The nickname, which prosecutors highlighted in the headline of a press release, is particularly telling, coming a week after the president called members of the violent gang Animals. Joel Martinez, 23, admits he murdered the 15-year-old as part of his initiation as a homeboy into the Mara Salvatrucha, which, of course, is the MS-13 gang's full name. I stabbed the culero 3 times. He stared at me and asked if I was going to stab him. And he said, yes, the Mara rules you. Yeah, I'd have to say I agree with the president. Those folks are animals. Let's go to Jim in Bellingham, listening on KGMI. Hey, Jim, welcome to the Lars Larson Show, and welcome to the Radio Northwest Network.
Okay, well, thanks for taking my call. I do disagree with you on a lot of things, as I've mentioned, but
that's good.
The one thing I do want to point out is that you were talking about the last hour was how the government can never do anything good,
but
you do know, can I make a point? You do know that what's the overhead for Medicare? What's the bureaucratic overhead?
Well, you got all the talking points, don't you? And here's what the talking point is. It's 3%. Do you know why Medicare's...
What is it in the private sector?
Jim, let me add a piece of data for you. Jim, let me add a piece of data for you. The way that Medicare keeps the costs so low at their administrative costs, which they bury in the federal government, is by putting most of the work on the doctor's office. So when you go see your doctor has to maintain a whole if you're on Medicare, your doctor has to maintain a whole staff of people whose only job is not to do medicine. It's to chase money. It's to fill out paperwork and fill out forms. And when they're denied, so Mrs. Johnson at age 85 goes to see her doctor. He says, we're going to do these tests. We're going to give you these medicines. They fill out all the forms. Medicare denies it. The staff goes back to work and puts them in again. So in other words, all they did was they shove all their administrative costs off the government onto the doctor's office. Where do you think the doctor gets the money to pay for all that staff? He has to add it into his fees, so you still end up paying the cost one way or the other. So do you think that Medicare is a well-run system? Because I guarantee you, I could open up the phone lines right now and talk to people on Medicare who can't find a doctor, who can't get the treatment they need.
I'm on Medicare, and I go to a good doctor.
If you had to find a new one, how much luck do you think you'd have right now? Because my understanding is...
I don't know, but that's not necessarily something the capitalist system is going to correct. And I would point out...
Sure it would.
That, you know,
the capitalist system will correct any...
Medicare doesn't pay CEOs. How much did Bill McGuire retire?
They don't pay CEOs. Can you imagine all the bureaucracy in the federal government that runs Medicare right now? If you think there isn't a lot of overhead at the federal government level, Jim, I think you are mistaken. Now, I know you like it because the system works out for you. God help you if you have to find a new physician, because an awful lot of physicians right now are saying, I'm not taking any new Medicaid or Medicare patients because they can't afford to, because they get paid a fraction. I mean, imagine if anybody is working in a business. I'm in radio. If you're a mechanic, if you're an HVAC person, if you're a plumber, if you did plumbing for a government agency, and when you did a $100 job, they gave you $52 for the job. And you said, hold on, this is a $100 job. They said, yeah, our compensation rate for the government jobs is $52 on the 100. You'd say, well, I can't afford to do that. No, you can't. And most doctors have a tough time affording taking those people. Let's go to naysayer Bradley. Hey, Bradley, you're a naysayer, too. What's on your mind today? Where do you and I disagree?
About the homeless and the drugs. First off, it's a pleasure to be on your show. I love listening to you.
Thank you, sir.
I don't have a job, and it's my choice. I know this sounds bad.
Are you independently wealthy?
No, I live off the state. I've just found in the last 8 years, if you know what X's and O's to write in the box, I get my rent paid, my phone's free, my food stamps. Out of boredom, I took a job earlier this year at a construction company, mostly roofing, and he hired a bunch of illegals. And these guys at lunch break, I mean, there's no English, which is fine. You know, that's that's
we're into about five different topics at this point. So you're a professional deadbeat.
This is my choice. Yeah. Well, I wouldn't say that, sir.
I would.
But these guys got hired the same day. Three of them showed up.
Well, you're griping about the other guys working. Do you have any particular skills that you could put to work in applying for a job? Do you have anything you could say, I'm really good at X?
I'm pretty good at everything, but I just wrote down that
you're good at everything, but you can't find a job competing with a bunch of illiterate, illegal aliens? You must not have the skills I'm talking radio for talking like that. We just dropped him, and his number, yeah, we've got his number. I'm tempted. You know what, folks? I'm so tempted in cases like this to say, here's his phone number, fill his phone up. But I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that. You know, I wish I could pull it off like Donald Trump does when he says, I'm not going to talk about this. And then he talks about it. But I'm not going to do it. I am so tempted. For people who talk that way on my radio station, on my radio show, on 24 stations around the Northwest, I would love to fill your phone number, but we're not going to do it. You got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Glad to be with you and glad to take your calls. We're live on the Radio Northwest Network, and that's 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. And to answer your question ahead of time, I get a lot of people saying, well, this isn't really Lars writing back, is it? Let me tell you something. For 21 years, nobody has answered my email but yours truly. Me and only me. If you get an answer back, it's coming from me. It's not coming from Donovan. It's not coming from Jackson. It's not coming from Carl. It is coming from me. Our Twitter poll today. Should a school be able to suspend a student over a pro-Trump T-shirt? It happened to one student going to Liberty High School in Washington County. Brought to you, the Twitter poll that is today, by Ultimate Truck Service. If you rely on trucks for your business, keep your biggest assets on the road and running right. Online at ultimatetruckservice.com. I ask you this. In yesterday's Twitter poll, I said, should we pull all of our kids out of public school until new gun laws are passed? That was the suggestion of the dimwit who used to be the education secretary under President Obama. 90% of you joined me in voting no on that. Only 10% of you said yes. And a little bit earlier, I was lauding the Wright family, which owns the Seattle Space Needle. It's not owned by the city. It's not owned by the county. It's not run by the federal government. It is owned and operated by a private family. And they're going to put $100 million into renovating the whole Space Needle. That's a lot of money, but they're going to repaint the whole thing. They're going to improve the HVAC. They're going to put in brand new elevators. They're going to put in floor-to-ceiling glass on the observation level. John Carlson and I have actually run all the way to the top of that tower in the Race to Space race a while back. Believe me, I was a little bit out of breath, and John finished considerably ahead of me. But that's okay. It was well worth doing it once, like many things. Curtis writes in, Lars, I was listening to you on the radio today, and you mentioned the Space Needle's upcoming renovation and how it would probably cost considerably more if the government were doing it. I completely agree with you, as I do HVAC trade work, and every government job I've been on has paid out what's called prevailing wage to us. If I work private jobs for 11 months and then do a government job for 1 month, the payout to me is so much higher on the latter that it puts me significantly into the next tax bracket. Prevailing wage for me is nearly triple my regular wage. I guess I shouldn't complain, but I have to wonder where that money could be spent if they had me at a more realistic wage. Schools, roads, public safety, firearm safety, training programs, wasteful. Thanks, Lars. God bless and your team. See, that's the thing. It's very, very, not provocative. It's very attractive. If you tell a worker you can make two or three times your regular wage, how's that work? Well, you know, we're using the taxpayers' money, so we can spend a whole lot more of it to buy the same thing that the private sector would buy for a half or a third of that price. Now, does it make sense to you? Probably not. And I applaud Curtis for being one of those people willing to actually say, this benefits me, but it really doesn't make any sense to do things that way. Let's go to Dave in Issaquah, Washington, listening on Talk Radio 570 KVI. Hey, Dave, welcome to the program. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lord. Yeah, I wanted to make a comment regarding the Supreme Court ruling on the...
On arbitration, yeah.
On arbitration, yeah. It's disappointing, but I can see if they said, you know, the current law is written like this, and so we got to follow the current law.
That's what they effectively said. They said you have to follow the law the way it's written. So,
and the law probably will not be changed because businesses can easily give generous campaign donations to the congressmen and senators to make
sure. I think that's hogwash, and let me tell you why. Who are the five biggest entities that give money to political campaigns in America? Do you know?
Oh, businesses.
Nope.
They target certain legislation.
Nope.
They don't have to do it on a gross basis.
Dave, you're not listening.
They just have to target.
Dave, you're not listening. I said no. It's not businesses. The 10 biggest contributors to political campaigns nationally are labor unions. Who do you think they represent?
They do, but most of the complaints are not from non-union workers.
Well, I understand that, but the unions typically will take up causes that relate to people that they might like to represent at some point. And usually the cause of the unrepresented worker is going to be very similar to that of the represented worker. In other words, if a union, now unions have union contracts, many of which, by the way, require arbitration. But if you're saying, oh, this is because big business gives a lot of money to this congressman or that senator, I'm just telling you, the biggest contributors are labor unions who typically go to bat for labor. So, you know, if you say it won't be, tell me how you would rewrite a law. And I'm not a legislator, and I know you're not either. But would you want a law that says you can't require arbitration?
No. You could make exceptions where the law has been demonstrably broken by the employer.
But for a second. What you're determining in the arbitration of the court cases was law broken. If an employee walks in and says, hey, boss, I got shorted on my paycheck. And the boss says, well, what did you think you were going to get? And you said, well, I worked 5 hours of overtime Friday night. And the boss says, hey, yeah, you did. As a matter of fact, we're going to pay you the 5 hours of overtime. But if the employee says, I think I'm owed for doing this. And the boss says, no, that's not what you're owed for. And there's a disagreement about whether or not the law was broken or whether or not somebody's civil rights were broken. That's what you resolve in court. So when you say in cases where, you know, either the contract or the law has been broken, that's what the court or the arbitrator is there to decide. One side says it was, the other side says it wasn't. So you're kind of getting the cart before the horse by saying when you've determined that the law was broken, well, that's what either the arbitration or the court case is there to decide.
Well, you can, workers can have grounds for asking for additional compensation without a law actually being.
No, of course.
My main point is,
you can walk into the boss and say, if you want me to work Saturdays, I want this much more. And the boss can say, I'll pay it or you're fired. Or no, I'm not going to pay you that more. Yeah, of course you can get paid more without having a law passed. But do you understand my objection to lawsuits over arbitration? If you have an arbitration at the end of it, it's decided one way or the other. Whether you won or you lost, it's decided. In a court case, let's say you're the worker. You walk in and say, I think the boss shortchanged me. I'm going to bring a court case against him. So you sue him. You sue your boss, which is never a great idea. But you win. Guess what the boss can do? Appeal. And then you win 2 years from now. And the boss says, I'm going to appeal that one. He can appeal till the cows come home, and it can cost you a bucket of money, and the only people who win are the lawyers. Does that sound like a good way to go?
Lars.
Yes. You're not going to answer my question, are you? You're not going to answer my question, are you, Dave?
Lars.
Dave.
Okay.
Yeah, I want an answer to the question. Is that a good way to do things where nobody ever gets a final result?
Not for most people. It does not work for most people. Therefore, arbitration is a good idea for most situations. But there are situations where you have a large group of people who have been trodden upon by being systematically cheated out of their lunch hour or systematically cheated out of overtime or just regular time.
You go down to labor and industries and you say, hey, my boss makes me work through my lunch hour.
There's the nub of that is, Lars, I've actually talked to people at labor industry on behalf of friends who could not make such a phone call from their workplace.
Well, why would
and
they
you
have
know
to
know what the friendly people there said?
What did they say?
Well, they said, well, you have to have a worker come in from the workplace.
So?
and file a formal complaint.
So what?
It cannot be an anonymous complaint.
Well,
and
no, of course not. Would you, if you were the employer, Dave, would you want people to be able to complain anonymously where you don't even know who the person is or what their gripe is? I would rather have a worker come to me and say, hey, I think I'm getting shortchanged by lunch hour. I'd like to get paid for it. And if the boss says, no, you're going to work through your lunch hour and I'm not paying for it, you go to Labor and Industries and you file a complaint in your own name. Would you ever want, as an employer, to have people be able to make anonymous complaints about you? You never know who they are. They won't even take the time to go file the complaint or attach their name to it. Do you think that's a legitimate way of complaining about something? I'll bet this, David, in tomorrow at work, when you're at work.
Can I ask you a question?
No, hold up a second. Tomorrow at work, your boss is going to call you in and say, somebody here at the workplace, I can't tell you who, says that you're a full-on pervert and you're doing really terrible things to them. And you go, well, who's saying that? You go, I'm not going to tell you. It's anonymous. Would you accept that?
That's not abuse of a worker per se.
Sure it is. If you're doing perverted things to your fellow workers, you're going and urinating in their coffee cup or something really sick and disgusting.
Your boss calls you in
and says, somebody has anonymously accused you of doing this, but I'm not going to tell you who. Do you think that's a legitimate way to complain about somebody else's behavior in the workplace where you never know who's accusing you, Dave? Tell me you'd buy that.
Okay, Lars, here's the nub on that.
Now we're going to change the subject. I'm up against a break, Dave, but it's been entertaining. Back in just a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. You know, one of the things that happens, and I know you hear me do this with callers occasionally, I love naysayers, but I want them armed with some facts and some logic. So when somebody calls, like the previous caller, and says, well, we should have an anonymous way to complain about somebody at our workplace, what you should always do is something I do, and I flip it around and think, okay, if I want to be able to complain anonymously about people I work with, because I have a couple of jobs, I'm both an employer and an employee, if I want to be able to complain anonymously, would I be okay with people complaining anonymously about me? And when you think of it that way, that's why that tripped up that last caller, because he suddenly realized that he had just proposed the anonymous complaint process when you're on the complaining end of things. But if you got called into the boss's office and the boss said to you, hey, somebody says you've been doing something weird and perverted, or you've been stealing from the company, whatever it is that you've done wrong, and you say, who's saying I did that? When do they say I did that? And the boss says, I can't tell you, but we're probably going to discipline you or fire you for doing these things that have been complained anonymously about you. Nobody's on the receiving end of that would be willing to accept that kind of system, and yet I hear workers say, well, we ought to be able to do this. Really? Would you like to be on the other end of that? And as long as you're okay with being on either end of that transaction, complainee or complainer, I'm okay with that too. Let's go to Rick in Yakima. Hey, Rick, thanks for listening on KONA. Thanks for the call as well. What's on your mind?
I wanted to talk about the school problem here with kids shooting other kids. I thought maybe it would be a good idea. I don't know what anybody else thinks, but I think a big old fence going all the way around and putting somebody on the east side, west side, south side would be a great idea. And then we could have the kids checked every morning. You know, that I think that'd be the safest way.
You mean just a big fence around the school?
Yeah, a fence.
And then you'd have to screen people through the fence, right?
Right. It would take an hour or two. Who cares? But we're talking about safety, you know.
No.
And the thing is, we'd have to hire extra people. But you know what? They take a lot of money out of my taxes and for the school. So that would be great. To me, that would be a great idea.
Well, you know, I when you think about a good size high school like 1,000 kids. So you'd have to staff up with full-time security from about 7 in the morning till, 5 or 6 o'clock at night.
Right.
And you'd have to have enough full-time people to cover all the people going in and out of that building all day long. You might be talking about 5 or 6 employees per building times hundreds, well, in the Northwest, thousands of schools throughout the Northwest.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about the whole United States because I just feel that we spend a lot of money on other things that for instance, the homeless guy that you were talking to, he gets free food stamps. He gets things that, you know, a lot of people get free. I guess being homeless, I figured we could put out a little more tax money to do that.
Well, I want to make the school, I want to make the schools safe, and I think one of the best ways to do it would be to harden the school's entrance. They knew that when that young man walked up to the school in Texas last Friday morning, it was hot as blazes down there. It was already very warm because it's that time of year, and he was wearing a big trench coat. Now, why was he doing that? To cover up the weapons that he was carrying. And that's one of those see something, say something situations where something should have been done, and they should have screened him in or out of the school and said, what's the deal with the trench coat? Why are you wearing a heavy coat, a full-length coat, in the middle of some very hot weather? I think that the young lady, the first person that he shot and killed, who was a young lady he was interested in romantically, she had apparently told her parents 2 weeks previously that he had threatened to kill her. And she said, if I end up dead, he's the guy who did it. Well, her words turned out to be very prophetic, but I'd rather have words, rather than being prophetic, I'd rather have people hear that. When a parent hears that, there's a guy at school who's acting weird, pick up the phone and call the school. And if they're not already aware of him, then you should make them aware of him. And if he's threatened to kill somebody and it's a credible threat, that's a crime in every community in America. It's a crime to make a credible threat to do somebody physical damage.
So you don't think the fence going all the way around would protect
I don't think so. We already have a wall around the school. If you lock the other doors and you make everyone enter through one door, if you do what the Gladstone schools, I still want to talk to Bob Stewart, the superintendent, because I think it's a terrific thing they've done. It is now buzz-in entry. If you're walking in the middle of the day, you have to walk up to a camera, talk to the lady in the office, explain why you're coming into the school, and then they make a decision whether or not to let you come in. And then they insist that you come to the front door. In fact, as they're remodeling all these schools in the Northwest, here's what I'd suggest. Make the front entry more like going through some of the security at TSA. If they buzz you in the first door and they think there's something hinky about you, call the school resource officer and say, we got a guy down here that we're not entirely sure about. Can you come down and check him out before we let him in the second door of that airlock? You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you live on the Radio Northwest Network. I'm glad to get to your calls and emails a bit later, but I want to turn to a friend of mine who I want to comment on this situation. Just let me outline it for you. You have a young lady who decides to do something that is a crime. The crime is called a straw purchase of a firearm. What it means is if you can't buy a gun in America because you're a convicted criminal and you find somebody who has a clean criminal record, in this case, a girlfriend, and you say to the girlfriend, I'd like you to go buy the gun for me and then deliver it to me. It requires the girlfriend to go to a gun store, to an FFL dealer, as they're required to, federal firearms licensee dealer. And to tell the dealer that you're buying the gun for yourself and sign a piece of paper that in which you answer a lot of questions. One of them is this gun actually for you? And it reminds you that buying a gun for someone else is a crime. And then you sign at the bottom attesting that everything you've answered on that form is true. And if you've told a lie in anything you've said and signed it, it's called false swearing. So you're committing a crime. You're committing a crime by purchasing a straw purchase or conducting a straw purchase for a firearm. Now, imagine if the young lady who does this does it not once, but nine different times. And imagine that the guns she purchases in these straw purchases, committing a crime each time, are going to her boyfriend, who she then vouches for while he's in custody. And he gets out of custody and he goes off and he murders three people using some of the guns that you obtained for him. What do you think should be the appropriate punishment for someone who's done something like that so that we can both punish her and maybe deter other people from committing similar crimes? Would you say that 12 months in prison is sufficient punishment? I would say not. But I thought I'd turn to Dan Mitchell, who's the co-owner of Sporting Systems Corporation, which is an FFL in Vancouver, Washington. And I think he knows the law well. He is an FFL, while I am not. And I thought I'd ask him that. So, Dan, welcome to the program. Is a year in prison enough for Andrea Sibley?
Absolutely not. No, it's a ridiculous slap on the wrist.
Why do you think the system, and you've got some suggestions too, this was a case tried in federal court, U.S. District Court in Tacoma, and she had previously pleaded guilty to aiding and abetting a felon in possession of a firearm and making a false statement during the purchase of a firearm, but she apparently did this 9 different times for 9 different guns and delivered the guns to her boyfriend, who is now convicted of, Brent Leister, who's convicted of killing, murdering three people with those firearms. Why do you suppose they went light on her?
Trying to figure out what prosecutors are doing on federal gun laws and state gun laws, it's a complete crapshoot, understanding what they're actually going to charge people with. This woman should have been charged with 9 different counts under the federal statutes, which are up to 10 years in prison and $250,000 fine per violation. And that's just the federal part. The other part is the state didn't prosecute. The state has similar laws that also have pretty aggressive penalties. And, our attorney general in the state just loves to go after firearms. Bob Ferguson is up there, promoting, the 1693s and things like that. But they didn't file any charges against her under the state statutes, which would add on another 5 years per incident. So 9 times, it's 45 years under the state statutes, and she wasn't charged with those at all.
Now, she could have received, if you did the math, 135 years in prison and $2.5 million or greater in fines if the courts and the state and federal authorities had chosen to do it.
Correct. And I understand a lot of times the states and the federal government will decide who's going to prosecute who for who's got the best case and where they can get the best bang for the dollar. But in an instant like this, in a time that is so politically charged in relations to gun rights, to be demanding more and more laws when you can't enforce the most basic and elemental firearms laws like these for delivering firearms to prohibited persons, and a 1-year sentence is just, it's absolutely ludicrous.
Well, it sends a really strange message at a time when we're told that there's huge concern, not only because of what happened in Texas on Friday, what happened in Parkland, Florida a few months ago, what has happened in various places in public settings where there have been mass killings of one kind or another, that we say, well, we need new gun laws. They're not using the laws that are already on the books. And, Dan, when I've talked to prosecutors, oftentimes they'll say, we take guilty pleas for 90% of the felonies we deal with because, not because it's easy, but because there may be a question. Do you think we can get a conviction on this one? Well, in the case of a straw purchase of a firearm, most stores, I think I might be able to say all gun stores, when you walk in to buy a gun, you give your picture ID. They take a photocopy of it. They have you fill out a form and you put your name on it. You sign your name. So that's the false swearing part. There's usually a video camera or two in most gun stores. So if you were worried about being able to prove it to a jury and you said, well, here's the young lady, here's the video of her buying the gun, here's the photocopy of her picture ID, here's a witness or two or three or six from the gun store who saw her buy it, and and by the way, here's the signature, and we've got a signature expert that says it's her signature. I don't think you should have any problem proving that kind of thing to a jury, should you?
Absolutely not. And if you've proven it at the federal level, which they did, then it's a slam dunk at the state level. So give her her federal sentence, and then when that's done, she should have a state sentence waiting at the end of that. It's so easy to prove in these instances because she signed the 4473. She signed the Washington pistol transfer application as well. Whether they had video or not would depend on how long the store retained its video records. But we've provided that on straw purchases, attempted straw purchase here in the store. We gave the ATF office the 4473, the contact, it was a private party transfer, and provided all that information to ATF. He showed back up a few weeks later, and he had identified the boyfriend that she was purchasing the firearm for. And you know, he wasn't in, we didn't have his, any of his information. We provided it to ATF. They found him and went after them.
Well, and you wouldn't have a tough time tying her to him, since they were boyfriend and girlfriend, apparently lived together. She had witnessed him pistol whipping a former girlfriend, did nothing about it. And of course, there was the letter that she wrote to the courts while he was in custody, testing to, I guess, his stability, so that they, the courts were in, you know, were inclined to let him go. And while he was out on bail, he, or out on release, he went out and murdered three people, and he's been convicted of those murders. So tying her to him and tying her to the deaths of three human beings, you would think would bring about a tougher sentence. And yet, Dan, I've told you before, I run into these cases all the time where they say, well, we're prosecuting so-and-so for 20 counts of this, and we're giving him a year and a half somewhere. And I just wonder, are you really trying to stop the problem, or just slap people on the wrist?
Yeah, this is clearly just... they're taking the path of least resistance. They've got the conviction on him. They've got a federal conviction on her, and they're just passing the buck and not moving and not going ahead and prosecuting the state charges or prosecuting the federal charges to the fullest extent. I think it's atrocious that the state did not do their due diligence in pursuing the state charges. Those, because they've been proven in a federal court already, your case is already made at the state level.
And by the way, Dan,
you put her away for a long time.
I'm talking to Dan Mitchell, who's co-owner of Sporting Systems. Since you're involved as an FFL, how tough can the federal government be on you as an FFL if you get a comma out of place on a piece of paperwork?
I sign the exact same form, and if I knowingly sign a form with false information on it, for each form that I sign, it's a punishable up to 10 years in prison and up to a $250,000 fine per offense. So, you know, people ask it, you know, people don't, they don't necessarily ask us to do things that are illegal. They just don't necessarily know things that are illegal. And, you know, and we inform them of those things, and you get a whole lot of, well, can't you just do this one time? It's like, absolutely not. There's no point in there's nothing you could do ever that would make it worthwhile to me, for me to give up my freedom for 10 years for you. I can stop you right there. We don't need to go any further. What you're asking us to do is illegal, and then we can't do it.
You know, it's funny. I've told you that there are times I transfer a pistol from one state to the other, which you have to do. If I'm buying a new one, I have to have it transferred up to Washington State because I'm a Washington resident. And the gunsmith I've gone through to for years, he told me one time they added a new question to the form. It requires me, the person who fills out the form, to define myself as either Hispanic or non-Hispanic, in addition to marking down whether I'm white, black, or otherwise. And I asked him about that, and he said, oh, you got to mark that one. I said, what happens if I don't? He says, if you don't and I don't notice it, the ATF will be in and all over him saying, you have to have all your customers mark Hispanic or non-Hispanic, or it's a violation and we could pull your license, we could fine you. So it seems they take all these little picayune regulations that don't seem to have any direct application to crime prevention, like whether or not the buyer is Hispanic or not. Well, who cares and what difference does it make? But he says, if you don't mark that box, well, the ATF will be all, BATF will be all over you. But apparently, if you do straw purchases, the punishment's relatively light.
Yeah, he's exactly right. You know, you have to be meticulous on your forms and your paperwork. I've been doing it all day. I don't actually sell guns anymore. All I do is paperwork.
All you do is paperwork.
I've got a stack of 4473s. You know, I probably got 80 of them sitting here on my desk in front of me, and I have to go through and double check every single line, you know, that's been done, you know, on the computers and signed off by our, you know, the employees and by the customers, and then enter them into our distribution records. And anything that's wrong, there's a very specific way that you have to fix it. And if you don't fix it in the prescribed manner that the ATF dictates, you get in trouble for that. So, you know, we're very, very meticulous. We self-audited our records. We just finished that a couple months ago and went through every single thing. And, you know, and we found plenty of these, you know, just little things. And we, We've got a very specific process to go through to get them fixed so that we don't get our license pulled. And that's a meticulous amount of paperwork, and we get in a lot of trouble for it.
No doubt. Hey, Daniel. Daniel, I'm up against the break, but I wanted to thank you for coming on. I appreciate your friendship, and I appreciate you giving us some of your expertise today.
Oh, you betcha. Happy to help.
Thank you, sir. That's Daniel Mitchell, the co-owner of Sporting Systems Corporation. Back in just a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. A couple of things I wanted to mention. First of all, in Spokane, their local utility company, Avista, is going to spend $165 million over the next 2 years. Are they spending it on power generation equipment? No. Are they spending it on electric lines to deliver the power to homes and businesses? No. They're going to spend it on smart meters. $165 million worth of smart meters. Now, I understand that there are ways that better metering may let people make better decisions about how to use electricity and natural gas. But that is a lot of money. The meters, they say, will allow people to track their energy use within a 24-hour period and will help the utility more quickly respond to power outages. There are 450,000 customers in Washington State who will be able to sign up for the alerts if their energy use begins to exceed their average consumption level. So you can get your local power utility to act like the worst mother-in-law in the world. Aren't you using too much power this month? But the other thing I think they may be able to do, because when smart meters first came along, there was an awful lot of talk by people who said, well, at some point, your utility company may have the power through the smart meter if you have smart appliances to turn them on and off. That's if you like the idea of your local utility company saying, hey, Lars isn't using his water heater right now, we can turn it off. Or Lars shouldn't be running his air conditioning as much in the summertime or his heat so much in the wintertime. If you want your local utility company to be able to decide how much power you use and actually regulate it themselves, if you're comfortable with that idea, because I'm not, but if you are, you'll probably like the idea of all those smart meters, and you better like them because you're paying for them. Let's go to Zach, first of all. Hey, Zach, welcome to the Lars Larson Show on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind today?
Hey, Lars, thank you for having me on, and thank you for bringing the facts every day.
I do what I can.
Your Twitter poll,
yeah,
about Liberty High School. I'm actually a graduate from there,
yeah,
in 2009, and it really baffles me, kind of the hypocrisy to suspend this student, considering in the 2008 election, they told us that we could come in late, about a half hour late, I believe, to watch the inauguration of President Obama.
They did.
Wow. They did. And so I chose not to because I was not a supporter of President Obama. So I'm not. And when I showed up to my first period class that day, it was English class, my teacher said, well, did you watch the inauguration? I said, no, I did not. And she said, kind of baffled and like taken aback, almost offended, I think, that I said, no, I did not take part in that. And she said, well, why not? I said, well, how come we weren't allowed to come in half hour late when President Bush was inaugurated?
What did she say?
The president. She just didn't have a very much of a response. Again, just kind of, she just seemed so shocked and kind of appalled. And it's very just, again, hypocrisy at its finest that they would want to prevent this student from having his own political speech, yet on a school-wide basis, they would want to kind of push a more liberal agenda.
You know, it's funny, Zach, that I'm never surprised when people have different political opinions than mine. I mean, sometimes at the same time, sometimes there's not. But I get the sense from what you said, and I've seen it myself, that when you talk to liberals, they're always baffled when somebody else has a different point of view. See, I think if you're an adult about things, I mean, if you're older than 5 years old, you understand that people like different things. They like different kinds of ice cream. They like different kinds of automobiles. They like different kinds of houses. And they like different kinds of politicians and political policies. And for some reason, once you're on the liberal side of things, you become so tunnel visioned that you can't even imagine the idea that somebody else might think differently than you do. Zach, congrats on getting out of Liberty High School. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you, and I'm going to be glad to get back to your phone calls and emails shortly at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Emails go to talk@larslarson.com. You've heard an earful from me about what I think is the foolish move by the Seattle City Council, even by its mayor, who suggested a smaller tax than the head tax that Shama Sawant, member of the city council, had suggested. Originally, they wanted $500 a head for each and every employee of every company in the city that had a gross revenue of more than $20 million. Now, it was aimed, I think, primarily at Amazon, which would have been the biggest company covered by the tax. Instead, they have passed a tax that's slightly smaller, about half as big, $275 a head, and it's going to hit 600 different employers. And I think it's one of the dumbest things that any city council has ever done. So I thought I'd get somebody on, and perhaps he can give you a different perspective. Caleb Heimlich joins me now, who's chair of the Washington State Republican Party. Caleb, nothing against you, but I would love to hear the head of the Democrat Party explain how this is a great idea for one of the biggest cities on the West Coast to pass this kind of head tax. What do you think of it?
Well, you're absolutely right, Lars, and thanks for having me on. We actually sent out from the state Republican Party a couple days ago a missing poster for our governor, Jay Inslee, because he has been absolutely silent on this issue as well. Look, this is a policy that 8 Democrats on the city council voted right alongside a socialist. And it's an atrocious policy. I mean, Rahm Emanuel, hardly a fiscal pro-business conservative, called Chicago's job tax a job-killing measure and repealed it in 2014. Their job tax, their head tax, was only $48 an employee. Ours is 6 times higher, as you noted, $275 per employee. Amazon came out against it. Starbucks came out against it in scathing statements, which is shocking, especially considering that both Starbucks and Amazon are headed by Democrat donors, Jeff Bezos and Howard Schultz. But the Democrats are persisting in pushing a very foolish policy that's really going to kill jobs in Seattle. It was interesting this week, Pierce County, which is just to the south where I live, is now passed a policy where they will give you a $275 credit for creating jobs in Pierce County, which I thought was great and shows that there's a Republican county executive down there. I mean, for us, I think this is a great messaging point. It shows that, look, Republicans are the party of common sense, the party of economic growth, and the Democrats are stuck pushing 1950s-style socialist policies that are not going to move our state and our city forward.
Have you noticed as well that Cupertino, California, which is the home of the big Apple headquarters down in California, they're now talking about following Seattle's lead. So some of the insanity seems to be spreading, and they seem to be giving some of these big companies an open invitation to simply move somewhere else the first time they get the opportunity or feel the need to build a new headquarters. Why build it in a place that's tax unfriendly? Take it to a place that actually wants you.
Yeah, I mean, that's what scares me as a homeowner. I do live in Pierce County, thankfully, but as somebody who's bought a home and has a family there and am concerned about future property values and others, when you have Amazon already looking for HQ2, which if Seattle continues with being hostile to business, they may end up be looking for HQ1 elsewhere. And there are a lot of other cities across the country that are pushing much more pro-business, business-friendly policies. I was talking to someone on the RNC from Tennessee. He's like, hey, down in Nashville, we're all about bringing employers in, not chasing them out. And so it's incredibly foolish for these cities to be pushing this. And I think, like we've said, it's a logical extension of what Governor Inslee and the Democrats have been trying to do in Olympia for the last couple of years. And that's why we're committed to flipping our state here in 2018. I think this gives us a great contrast to show why we need people to vote Republican.
Well, Caleb, that was going to be my next question. In some ways, Shama Sawant and Mayor Durkin have just given you a tremendous campaign opportunity, haven't they?
Yeah, 100%. I mean, look, as we've been messaging this past session, this was the first year Democrats have controlled our state, all three branches. We had the majority in the state Senate for the past five, but we lost it last November. And this year, what did Democrats do with the majority? They were pushing a capital gains income tax. They pushed a carbon tax. They refused to reduce car tabs. They increased property taxes. They raided the rainy day fund. We have Democrats that can never have enough revenue, and they're seeking to take more and more money out of your pockets. And then Republicans are saying, wait a minute, we can do this. We can balance the budget without raising taxes. And this tax in Seattle is incredibly unpopular. Cairo 7 had a poll. 54% are against it, only 38% in favor of it. And that's in Seattle. And so when you go statewide and when we're competing in these suburban districts, they want legislators that are going to fight for them, fight for their pocketbooks, fight to increase jobs in our state. They don't want people that are following a socialist around and think that's a great idea for public policy. So it's absolutely going to be something we're talking about heavily, and I think it gives us a lot of ammunition going forward.
Well, Caleb, I've got a couple of buddies up at our affiliate station, KVI in Seattle, that carries this program, and John Carlson, who's got a lot of political experience, and Kirby Wilbur, who has about the same, both indicated that they want to join together and try to figure out a way to put this thing on the ballot so voters can vote on it this November. I don't know. I would love to see it on the ballot. I'm not sure that the city of Seattle and its voters will vote it down, but they might. And is there any chance that the Washington State Republican Party can get involved in that effort? I guess they need 17,000 signatures or so within about 25 days to be able to throw it on the ballot for this November. I think it's a terrific idea. Can the party get involved in that?
Absolutely. And I know they're making a lot of progress. Saul Spady, the grandson of Dick Spady, who formed Dick's Drive-In, which is a burger joint in Seattle, has been leading the effort to gather signatures. And we're absolutely working with them to help give voters a say, because I think this could be a big tipping point for citizens in Seattle. You know, where the city has been managed very poorly, and you see taxes have gone up and up and up. Revenues at the city have gone up by over 30% just in the last 3 years, and it's not going to solve any problems. Homelessness is getting worse. We've got heroin injection sites that the Democrats are pushing. They don't have solutions, and the city is not working for just regular people. And so I think you get to a point where you say enough is enough, and I think this head tax might be that kind of final thing that pushes people to say, you know, I've been voting Democrat for the last 30 years. It's time to take a look elsewhere, because we see at the national level with President Trump and national Republicans cutting taxes, promoting pro-growth policies, that the contrast could not be clearer. One party's on the right side of history and the other's not.
I'm talking to Caleb Heimlich, who is chair of the Washington State Republican Party. The last issue, and this is kind of on my wish list, I wish we could find somebody who is perhaps an accountant or has some expertise who could take a hard look at the money they're already spending on this homeless problem. Because every time I hear that Seattle and King County are spending about $200 million, I think Portland is spending more in the range of $60 to $80 million. These are massive sums of money. And it makes me believe that since there are only a few thousand people living on the streets, that the amount of money per homeless person is in the $30,000 to $50,000 a year range. I mean, it's almost like we're paying these people five-figure salaries, except I have a feeling most of the money is being spent on a giant bureaucracy that's grown up around the problem, and that very few dollars actually get down to the ground level, except that I don't have anybody with the expertise to be able to dig through all those city documents. But can you imagine what a bombshell that would be if you said, well, we're throwing $200 million at it. This tax is supposed to raise another $50, but here's where the $200 million is going to. Lots of salaries, lots of offices, lots of computers. And how much of that $200 million actually gets to direct services to the people who are living on the streets? I might be wrong, but I suspect an awful lot of it gets just gobbled up in government.
You are absolutely right, Lars. Jim Bruner at the Seattle Times, not directly related to the homelessness issue, but had a big piece about all the people working for the city that were making well over $100,000. And you're exactly right. City government is incredibly inefficient. It goes to pay for government bloat. It doesn't actually go to help people. An example of that is that there was a story in April about how the city of Seattle is paying $12 million per mile for bike lanes. They're not adding anything. It's just like, I can go paint that, and I can paint a mile for a heck of a lot less than $12 million, I'm sure. So,
you could probably do it with a brush and a roller cheaper than that, even if it took you a year. Yeah, pay me $11 million salary and $1 million for paint. I'll paint the thing for you.
Yeah, so it just shows how inefficient government is, and that's why we need more Republicans, because Republicans are focused on running government efficiently and actually helping people and solving problems.
Hey, Caleb, thanks for the work you do, and we're going to do what we can. In fact, John and Kirby and I have been talking about maybe a live broadcast sometime the next couple of weeks where we could invite people to come by and say, here's your one-stop shopping for signing the petition to be able to get this thing done. If we can do that and do it legally and do it the right way, we're going to make it happen.
Sounds great. Well, thank you for having me on, Lars. Appreciate it.
It's always a pleasure. Keep up the good work. Caleb Heimlich. And by the way, my invitation is open to the head of the Washington State Democrat Party or the Oregon Democrat Party. If they want to come on and talk about how this cockamamie tax from the city of Seattle, now being copied by Cupertino, California, and now being opposed by places like Pierce County, if you can tell me how it's a great idea, I would let the Democrats come on and give their best sales pitch for a head tax on the most successful big companies in a big city. You're listening to the Lars Larson Show. Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. Is there just a full-fledged war going on capitalism? And I got no dog in the fight on this one. It's Airbnb. I don't have an Airbnb. I haven't used Airbnb, but I got nothing against it. Now the mayor of Portland, I guess trying to double down on what the mayor of Seattle and Shama Sawan are doing, has just announced a $1.2 million tax on Airbnb and its competitors, and they say this is going to fund home ownership for displaced families. Well, who's being displaced? It's like making the argument that if somebody builds a hotel instead of an apartment building, that if I, or, you know, if I ordinarily lived in an apartment building like I used to when I lived in Spokane or when I've lived earlier here in this area, that somehow I'm being displaced because the housing is being put to a different use. Portland Mayor Ted Wheeler, this was broken by Willamette Week and Rachel Monahan, is proposing new taxes on Airbnb and other short-term rental companies. His office projects the taxes could bring in between $1.2 million and $2.5 million. The city plans to levy a $4 a night charge per room on companies that facilitate short-term rental bookings. The mayor's office plans to spend the money on funding home ownership as part of a strategy to rectify displacement. Home ownership represents an opportunity to create generational wealth, says Wheeler spokesman Michael Cox. So as the city works to address housing affordability, we have to focus on creating home ownership. They're going to have a separate 2% charge on hosts who use Airbnb and other companies for booking that'll go into the tourism fund. That's projected to bring in $720,000 to $840,000 a year. The taxes will go before the council next month, so right in the middle of summer when nobody's paying attention. It says short-term rentals take apartments off the market for people who live there. It's only fair that companies like HomeAway and Airbnb offset their impact. Wow. What a line of thinking. Another subject to talk to the mayor about the next time we talk to him. Let's go to, Zach from Oregon City. You had emailed me earlier. Zach, you're a high school student, is that right?
Graduated.
You graduated, but there are kids at Oregon City School, Oregon City High School, who are being told they can't wear their honor cords to graduation?
Yeah, so there's these things called advanced placement cords that the advanced placement teachers have put together so that people who have taken the advanced placement courses can be recognized.
Good.
And now the administration of Oregon City High School is saying that that was never a thing, and that it's discriminating.
Don't worry about it. It's a hard word. I had to practice for years to get it. So what? But why? What's their reasoning? Do they say that this is going to somehow make the other kids who didn't take the AP courses feel, like snowflakes?
That's my guess. My thing is that when I graduated, we had the honors kid and the AP kids at the front of the line for graduation, and they went up first. They got the diplomas first, and then the rest of the standard diplomas went up and got it. So my guess is this year around, people are being offended by it and want it to be changed.
Well, then why don't they work hard? Look, I didn't get a letter on my on a letter jacket because I didn't play in an athletic sport. I was on the speech team, and at some high schools, you can get a letter for doing speech and debate. At my high school, they didn't. So what? What's wrong with recognizing the kids who worked extra hard to take college-level courses while they were still in high school? That's hard work. It ought to be recognized, shouldn't it?
Yeah, exactly. And that's my thing. I took a college course in high school, but it was considered a standard class, so yeah. I didn't get the AP course. But my thing is I graduated by scraping. I barely graduated because I needed a single credit in an extra curriculum activity.
Yeah.
And I almost didn't get it. But I wasn't offended by the fact that all these other kids were getting up there and getting recognized for trying hard. I tried my butt off, but I didn't get the special treatment, and I wasn't offended by it.
I think that's outrageous that they're going to tell kids who've done extra hard work, which would also include athletics, but in this case, the AP cords that say, I took some AP classes and I did reasonably well in them. I think that's a good thing to recognize in kids and maybe a way to incentivize the other kids. But I guess, according to the folks running the schools these days, we no longer live in a meritocracy. You got the Lars Larson Show.